real pleasure to be here, and I'd like to tell you something about the Erdős-Rényi phase transition. Erdős was a remarkable human being. It's now been nearly 20 years since his passing, and he has really become a legendary figure, as he was during his life. Besides his incredible mathematics, he had a special spirit, and those of us that were fortunate enough to work with him, we all received some of that spirit. It's almost like a laying on of hands, if you wish, and we all hope that then when we deal with our students that we can pass some of that on to them. And many people have remarked, this is one of my favorites comments about working with Erdős by the mathematician Fan Chung at University of California in San Diego. Okay, so I want to talk about the Erdős-Rényi process. Really, it'll be in two parts. Okay, so first let me tell you what the process is. You begin with n vertices. There's no geometry, they're just abstract vertices, and there are no edges between them. And at each round, you pick a random pair of points that haven't been picked before, and you join them. You make an edge between them. But this is not a planar graph. It's just an abstract graph. And then you get the evolution. Indeed, the title of this whole week is Random Graph Processes. And to me, this is the baseline random graph process. With foresight, let me say that define Erdős-Rényi time, that's just my own phrase, that n over 2 rounds is unit time. That turns out to be the right scaling to work with. And then it turns out, as I'll explain in much more detail, there is a phase transition when Erdős-Rényi time reaches 1. In fact, that's why I set up the scaling so that 1 was the critical point. In the modern world, though this was in the original papers in 1960, we look at the random graph G of NP, where, so you have N points, again, we think of these as labeled points, 1 through N, and each pair of points is joined independently with probability P. And now, the original process, if you stop at time t, the proportion of points is t over, if you stop at time, not time, if you stop after l rounds, the proportion of points is l over n choose 2. Well, it turns out that proportion and probability, while they're not tautologically the same, the results are pretty much the same. And we work in the modern world with the random graph G of NP, and there the scaling will be P equals T over N, and T equals 1 will be the critical point. So what happens is, so I'll start with just the facts, and then we'll come back and give some arguments, that we have a subcritical phase when T is less than 1, and in that phase, all of the components, by C1, I mean the largest component. And C2 is the second largest. So C1 is only of size logarithmic in N. And furthermore, all the components are what are called simple, which means they're either trees or cycles. In fact, there are very few cycles. Mostly they're trees, but that's the situation. But when t is greater than 1, the supercritical phase, we get what Erdős and Rényi called the giant component. So this is really the, right at the start in 1960, this was the central thing. In fact, they even had, sorry, I didn't put down the quote, they even said in their paper, usually they were very sort of almost brusque in their papers, but they said, boy, effectively to translate their English into my English, wow, this is really amazing, is what they effectively said. And so what happens is, at t greater than 1, you get what's called the giant component. And this component has size constant n, fact, we'll talk about what the constant is as a function of t. And it's a very complex component. That is, it's not a tree nor a unicyclic. Again, there's a lot more that you can say about it. And all of the other components are simple, and their maximum size is log n. So somehow between 0.99 over n and 1.01 over n, these components have come together. Not all of them. The graph is not connected. Connectivity doesn't occur till log n over n, but that's because of outliers. It's really, this is the place I want to concentrate on, is them coming together in the phase, what I call the phase, what is called the phase, for instance. Let's look near criticality. So here, caution, there's some double limits here. Suppose T is 1 minus epsilon, but now I'm thinking of epsilon fixed and then n going to infinity, but then I take epsilon going to 0. So be careful about that. I don't allow epsilon equal 1 over n here. Okay. Then the results are that all the components are simple, and the largest component has size log n, but we can put on an epsilon to the minus 2 in front of the constant. So for each epsilon, it's a constant, but then if you look at that constant as a function of epsilon, it's going like epsilon to the minus 2. And indeed, this is not just big O, it's theta. It's there in both directions. And I call that barely subcritical. When you're barely supercritical, when T is 1 plus epsilon, you get a giant component. And the size of the giant component is a constant times n, and that constant is not exactly 2 epsilon, but if you look at that constant as a function of epsilon, its asymptotics as epsilon goes to 0 is 2 epsilon. So we'll say that the largest component is of size around 2 epsilon n, and as I said before, it's not a simple component, and all the other components are simple, and all the other components have size epsilon to the minus 2 log n. Let me actually jump right here into the fine-tuning. So this works for any epsilon fixed, but suppose epsilon, now you let it be a function of n, how long does this dichotomy last? Well, in order for the dichotomy to ask to work, you've got the small components of size around epsilon to the minus 2, and you've got the giant component around the size, you've got C2 around epsilon to the minus 2, and C1 around 2 epsilon n. In order for that to be a dichotomy, you better have that the giant is giant. It better be a Jupiter, although I once said that and somebody checked. Actually, Saturn is not minuscule compared to Jupiter. Earth is, but okay. But anyway, so what this indicates is that the critical window, in fact, we'll talk a lot about this next, is when epsilon is n to the minus 1/3. That's where our giant component and our second largest component are becoming the same. Now, it looks like there's another log term, and for about 8 years, it looked like there was another log term. But then, when people looked at it really carefully, they were able to erase the log term. So it turns out that if you try and let epsilon go to zero, it stops when epsilon is n to the minus 1/3. And we'll say a lot more about that in the second lecture. Okay. Now, to me, the natural setting is the Galton-Watson birth process. You know, I don't think very much of Galton and Watson in terms of their social behavior. I mean, why did they do this? Because they did it. In fact, they said that they did it because they were afraid that the aristocratic families were dying out, and they were studying this. Now, that would be a terrible thing, so that was it. And also, I always start with Eve, but actually there was no Eve in their process. I wouldn't call them misogynistic, because in their process, females didn't exist at all. Okay, so that was. And furthermore, Watson, no, Francis Galton is known as the father of eugenics. So three strikes, you're out. But boy, it's beautiful mathematics. It's beautiful mathematics. So we're going to look at it. So here we go. We're going to create a tree. We start with Eve. She has Poisson mean lambda. It could be other distributions. Has Poisson mean lambda children. And then those children have Poisson mean lambda children. And those children have Poisson mean lambda children. And you keep on going. You might go on forever, which is a crucial thing to study. And you get some tree T. Okay. In the subcritical phase, the critical number here is lambda equals 1. That is when everybody is, on average, reproducing. So in the subcritical phase, like, for example, old China, until last year's change in their rules, or Italy today, in fact, most of Western Europe today, lambda is, lambda is less than 1, and that means, yes, those aristocratic families are going to die out. The tree is going to die. That's not hard to see, because you're not reproducing yourself. So if you go down to the nth generation, your expected number of people on the nth generation is lambda to the n. It's going to 0. So what happens is the tree is finite with probability 1. But when you're supercritical, there's a positive probability that, yay, the aristocratic families go on forever, and that the tree is... Now, the tree isn't infinite with probability 1. After all, Eve might be childless with probability e to the minus lambda. Eve might be childless, or, you know, Eve may give birth to Alice and Barbara, and they might be childless. I mean, other things can happen. But one can show, and indeed we will show, that the probability of being infinite is... It's not great. Oh, that doesn't, I wrote greater than, that can't be right. The probability of being infinite is greater than 0. Sorry. Certainly not greater than 1. That was an error. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. And let's look at that near criticality. So, again, if lambda is 1 minus epsilon, we can look at the distribution. So, we know it's going to be finite. In fact, we'll give the exact distribution, but let me give you the rough feeling. It's not obvious. Suppose that lambda is 0.999. Well, doesn't that look like lambda equals 1? Well, it does for a long time. It does until time around epsilon to the minus 2. Not an obvious result. Not an obvious scaling, but this is the scaling. What happens is the... Up until epsilon to the minus 2, you have a heavy tail phenomenon, which we'll talk more about. And then, after that, you get to some exponential decay. But up to epsilon to the minus 2, it's as if 1 minus epsilon looked like 1. And Poisson 1 does have a heavy tail. The probability of being... I just gave this to my students just 2 days ago. The probability of having size exactly k is on the order of k to the minus 3/2, which is a heavy tail phenomenon. Here you can't have heavy tail because you know it's... you don't have heavy tail, but it's kind of a heavy tail until you reach epsilon to the minus 2, and then you have exponential decay. And if you're barely supercritical at 1 plus epsilon, the chance of being infinite is like 2 epsilon. But when it's finite, we have a duality, which I'll come back to, where it looks pretty much like the 1 minus epsilon. So if you, in fact, there's an exact say, if you condition on it being finite, that is, you remove that 2 epsilon probability that it's infinite, then you get basically the 1 minus epsilon. Yeah. Okay? And what we'll see is that the Galton-Watson is the when we study the random graph, it's going to look like the Galton-Watson tree until it doesn't. Okay, that's going to be the idea. Okay, here's a wonderful argument why t equals 1 is the critical point. Totally non-rigorous, but Peter Lacks once told me that he reached a certain age where you know, he felt that the non-rigorous arguments were really important, and I've certainly reached that age. So here we go. I want to define the susceptibility . So here's, you have a graph on n vertices. You take the sum of the squares of the component sizes and divide by the number of vertices. But it's equally the same as saying it's the expected value of, if you pick a random point and look at its component size, and look at that expected value. And these are the same things, because if you have a component of size 10, 10 times you're getting 10. So these are the same. So that's called the susceptibility. It's a concept that's been around in mathematical physics for a long time, but I think I'm really pushing to have people look at it in the discrete world. So let's look at the Erdős-Rényi process. Now, all of this is a little bit of hocus-pocus because these are all things in probability, but let's not worry about that. And if we look at adding a single edge... So we want to look at the susceptibility at Erdős-Rényi time t. And when two components merge, what happens to the susceptibility? The two components, instead of the squares of the components, we have the square. Instead of the sum of the squares, we have the square of the sums. So we're multiplying by twice the product of the component sizes. And then we're scaling... by n, so we get this. And a single edge is increasing Erdős-Rényi time by 2 over n. So we get it's 2 over n times the sum over all pairs of components of this quantity, the probability that the first point was in component C, the second point was in component C prime, and then how much they're being increased. Okay. And here's the 2 over n. Okay. And now, of course, if the two points are in the same component, nothing happens to the susceptibility. But in the subcritical phase, that rarely happens because all the components are so small. So... again, waving our hands, we'll add in the term C equals C prime here. And then what we get is that this is just 2 over n times S squared of t. So we get that S of t plus 2 over n minus S of t is 2 over n times S squared of t. And I'm really not very good at differential equations, but I can solve this one. What happens is then this becomes S prime of t dividing by 2 over n. We say that S prime of t is S squared of t. It starts at 1, and that one has the solution 1 minus t to the minus 1. And so t equals 1 is when the susceptibility blows up. And again, these are some deep theorems in mathematical physics about, is the place where the susceptibility blows up the same place where you get an infinite component? In this case, it is. And indeed, despite all the hocus pocus, we get the right answer. This is the susceptibility at time t for t less than 1. And so t equals 1 is critical. All right. How do we study Galton-Watson? I like to use what I consider a very powerful idea. I call it fictitious continuation. That is, you take an infinite sequence of IID Poisson lambda variables, and you let xi be the number of... Let's assume we do breadth-first search. Turns out you can do it otherwise. Let x sub I be the number of children of the ith node. And the reason why it's fictitious is you might not get to the ith node. But the nice thing is then that Your underlying probability space is IID random variables, which is easy to work with. So just as an example, if the sequence was 210101, and I changed Eve to Alana, and then she gives birth to Brenda and Colleen, and then Brenda will have one child, Deidre, and then Colleen will have no children, and then Deidre will have Aaron. Oh, this was for Colin McDermott's retirement party, so the choice of names was meant to have a Scottish turn to it. Okay. And then Aaron has no children because of the zero. So actually the process has stopped, but still we can continue it fictitiously. We now add Fiona, who has no parent, and then she has two children. And in that sense, the process never ends. We get a random forest, but the actual Galton-Watson stops when it stops. And so when it stops, so T might be infinity. T is the size of the tree, is when this stops, but it might be infinity. But if it is a finite, that should be a capital T at the bottom. So if T is the size of the tree, let's define this ordered T tuple X1 through XT as the history. Okay. And now let's put on our computer science hats and think of this in terms of like a breadth first search. That is, we have a queue of vertices of nodes. And we look at the queue size Y, which initially is 1. It's just Eve or Alana when I said it. And each time the node gives birth to X sub t, at time T, the node gives birth to X sub T children, and then she dies. Okay, so we get this random walk where the step size is Poisson lambda minus 1. And the tree size is the first time that walk hits zero, but again with the understanding that it might be infinite. Now here's the theorem that gives the exact distribution for T sub lambda. And I will give a proof later, but this is a very nice formula. I like to look at things asymptotically, so let's look at what this formula means. In particular, when lambda equals 1, a lot of stuff cancels out, and when you apply Stirling's formula, you know, Stirling's formula, that square root 2 pi k, it's always so annoying, it never means it. Here it's critical. Here it's critical. When you work out the Stirling formula with lambda equals 1, you get a constant 1 over root 2 pi times k to the minus 3 halves. So it does have a heavy tail. The expected size is infinite. When I was the age of some of you, not you, younger, so some of you up here, and I first heard about distributions that were always finite, and yet they had infinite expectation, and I had an immediate reaction, which was I just laughed and laughed and laughed. I mean, I saw it formally, and, you know, yeah, it worked. It's just some crazy thing that will never, ever show up. You know, it's just somebody came up with it. But it turned out that was wrong, not the only time I've been wrong. And it turns out that when you look at percolation and you look at criticality, you frequently get this situation of something being finite with probability 1 and yet having infinite expectation, having what we call the heavy tail. That's sort of a roughly defined term. But the expectation is the sum of k to the minus 1 half, so it's infinite. Now, the way I like to look at T sub lambda is to compare it to T sub 1, and it differs by the lambda inverse. That's not so important if lambda is near 1, but what it really differs by is lambda e to the 1 minus lambda to the power k. And so what happens is when lambda is not equal to 1, you get an exponential drop. Because if you do your calculus, or tell your students to do their calculus, you'll find out that lambda e to the 1 minus lambda hits a maximum of 1 at lambda equals 1, and otherwise it's strictly less than 1. And so what we get is exponential decay. Now, how can we have exponential decay when we're supercritical? Well, this doesn't tell about the lump at infinity. It says it's exponential decay in the distribution plus a lump at infinity. But that doesn't come in here. And this is true whether lambda is less than 1 or greater than 1 or equal to 1. But when lambda is greater than 1, it doesn't tell the whole story, because you also might be infinite. All right, let's look at the probability, what I like to call immortality, that the process is going to be infinite. And this is the way that Galton and Watson did it. It's particularly nice with the Poisson has this wonderful, wonderful property. If you're going to have Poisson 5 children, and each one is a boy with probability of half and a girl with probability of half, then it's the same thing as you're having Poisson 2.5 boys and Poisson 2.5 girls, and those are independent events. And this is a remarkable property of the Poisson distribution. Okay, so what happens then, that's what I call the amazing property. So now, when are you infinite? You're infinite if and only if one of your children is infinite. If you're infinite with probability X, the number of your children that are infinite will be Poisson X lambda. So that will have to be not equal to 0, which is 1 minus e to the minus lambda. So we can now solve that equation. So we get this equation. Again, lots of great stuff for your bright freshmen here. Or for yourself. I mean, so here's 1 minus x. And there's certainly a solution at x equals 0. But if you look at e to the minus lambda x, it depends on whether lambda is greater than 1 or less than 1. If lambda is less than 1, they only touch at x equals 0. But when lambda is greater than 1, the slope of this curve is minus lambda. So it's going underneath. And this is, so we get two solutions, and apparently this led to some confusion, but the right solution is the non-zero solution. One way of seeing that is just that you have a random walk with positive drift, so with positive probability it's not going to return to the origin. But this can be shown.
This is more about the origin one, I guess.
Sorry?
This is more about the origin one.
Yeah. 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 So you can do it in a variety of ways. Okay. Let's look at.
You wrote it.
I wrote it the wrong way. Right. This is for lambda greater than 1. So, let's look at why I said that the component is like a Galton-Watson process. So you start out with a particular point and you want to create its component using breadth-first search. So initially you're at time t equals 0. You start your queue with that particular point. We'll have three kinds of points: the points that have been killed, the points that are in the queue but haven't yet been processed, and then all the other points, what I call the neutral points. So initially there are n minus 1 of them. So in breadth first search, when you get to the tth point, it looks for new vertices. It doesn't look for the old vertices. That's how because that's not going to expand things. It looks for new vertices, and there are n sub t minus 1 potential new vertices, and it gets each one with probability p, so that's its number of new vertices. You add them to the queue, and then the node dies, so the queue size is given by this formula. And then don't know what this is. N sub t. I don't know what this is. Forget about that. Okay. You have something about the neutral ones. Okay. And actually, we can do this. So N sub t should be... this is just wrong. It should be N sub t minus 1 minus... Yeah, it should be N sub t minus... Yeah, for... Yeah, this should be N sub t equals N sub t minus 1 minus the number of new points that were discovered. And we can actually do fictional continuation on this, and t will be the minimal time when it goes to 0. In this case, it's always going to be less than or equal to N, and that'll be the size of the component. Now, one could do this formally, that the number of neutral points is given at time t by a binomial distribution n minus 1, which is the number of points except for the one you started with, comma 1 minus p to the t. It's an interesting way to look at that. When you're analyzing breadth, and I actually came up with this, so I like it. When you're analyzing breadth-first search, normally the way you analyze it is you think of expanding out. But instead, think of the points as trying to get in. Okay? So what happens is, each point except the root, and let's pre-process the randomness, each point except the root keeps flipping coins until it gets ahead. And it gets ahead with probability P. And suppose it gets ahead on the 10th try. That means it's going to join the breadth first search tree on the 10th time. Now, there might not be a 10th time because of the fiction. Maybe the process aborted earlier. But then it will join. But now we're doing fictional continuation, so that really doesn't matter. In order for a point still to be neutral at time t, it had to flip tails the first t times. So this is an interesting thing about breadth-first search. You can analyze it going out, or you can analyze it with points trying to go in. And it's interesting to work with the two ideas. So the number, or you can get this formally from, if I had written this formula correctly, it would come out by induction. So the number of neutral points at time t, each of the non, except the point you started with, is neutral with probability 1 minus p to the t. And now again, you get a history. Here it has to be finite, x1 through xt. All right, well, why is one asymptotically the other? Well, let's just put PO for Poisson and GR for graph to distinguish the two processes. And another key thing about the Poisson is that if you look at Poisson n minus any constant, comma lambda over n, if you look at binomial n minus any constant, comma lambda over n, that distribution is like the Poisson. Actually, to me, that's the definition of Poisson. And the formula comes after. I mean, this is what Poisson is about. Poisson is if you've got a lot of mutually independent events and none of them occurs too often, and the mean number of events that occur is lambda, then it's going to be approximatable in the limit in some way. It's the Poisson process with mean lambda. To me, that's the definition of Poisson. Of course, I mean, then the formal thing is what you get in the books. But that's the way I think about it. So now, look at any potential possible history, like, say, 1-0 is a possible history. Let's compare the probability of getting that 1-0 in the Galton-Watson regime within the graph theory. So to get 1-0, x1, which is binomial n minus 1p, has to be 1. But that's the same as the Poisson being 1 asymptotically. And then Poisson n minus 2, comma p has to be 0. But again, that's the same as the Poisson being 0. And since you only have a finite number of terms, since each term, when you take the limit as n approaches infinity, each term in the graph process is going over to the Poisson process, therefore the product of these finite number of terms goes over to the product in the finite number of terms. And so what happens is you get the theorem that I stated, and then the corollary that's very useful is that if you look at the total size, well, that's just the sum over each one of the possible histories. There are only a finite number of histories. And so that limiting behavior holds as well. So that the probability that the graph process gets exactly k as n goes to infinity is the probability for the Poisson. But notice that k has to be fixed here. We can't take k equals square root of n or anything like that. So we have to be careful with the limits. K is fixed, and n is going to infinity. Here's a nice proof. I mean, there are lots of other proofs. But here, I promised you a proof of this statement, and here's the proof. I'm going to go from the Poisson to the graphs, and then I'll wind up with the result on the Poisson. So look at GNP with P equals lambda over N. What is the probability that the component of some particular point V has size K? Well, you choose the other K minus 1 points. Then you can have no edges from those K points to the remaining N minus K points. And then on those K points, you have to be connected. So that's exactly right. Now, what's the probability that you're connected? Now, K is fixed and P is going to 0. And if you look at those K points, they're acting like GKP. Again, there's a subtlety here. We haven't yet exposed those potential edges yet. So it's still behaving like GKP. So what's the probability that GKP is connected? Well, the exact formula is really complicated. But if K is fixed and P is going to 0, it's dominated by getting a tree. Because if you don't have a tree, instead of having P to the K minus 1, you're going to have a higher power of P, which is going to be smaller. So the asymptotics of being connected are simply, there are K to the K minus 2 ways to get a tree, Cayley's formula, times P to the K minus 1. All the other terms are higher powers of P. And now when you plug in and you just do some elementary stuff here, you get the answer. You get the answer. So this is a proof I like because, I mean, I like asymptotic stuff. So you're really proving something about the Poisson process. You go to the discrete and then you go back to, I always like arguments like that. It's sort of, my rough analogy is you want to find a real integral and you go into the complex numbers and you find the poles, but then you end up with a result about the real. So these are aesthetically pleasing things. Here's the duality that I wanted to mention. There's a right parenthesis missing here. That this is a precise result that if you let D and C, call them dual if D e to the minus D is C e to the minus C. And again, the function x e to the minus x goes up until it reaches 1, and then it goes down. So every number except 1 itself will have a unique dual. Then when you look at the formulas, if you condition the Poisson C, the supercritical, if you condition it on being finite, you get exactly, not approximately, you get exactly the Poisson process in the subcritical regime with this D. Now, when C is 1 plus epsilon, D is close to 1 minus epsilon, though there's some epsilon squared other terms here. What this turns out to mean, roughly, is that if you look at the random graph in the subcritical regime, C over N, where C is greater than 1. And if you remove the giant component, so you end up not with some M points, and on those M points, it's in the subcritical regime with C replaced by its dual D. So it's a very nice picture I always think this should be a movie, that as P increases, the components are coming together. And then you get this giant component. But if you erase the giant component from the movie, it's like running the movie backwards. So it's kind of a nice picture there with the duality. Okay. In terms of analyzing things, I'm just going to replace the binomial by the Poisson. It turns out the results are right. That would take some more technical work. And the analysis is technical enough as it is. Okay. So the subcritical regime is actually easier. The subcritical regime is easier. Because, you see, when lambda is less than 1, if you look at this procedure, it's stochastically dominated by, it should be binomial n minus 3, binomial n minus 6, but it's stochastically dominated by taking binomial n minus 1 comma p. Here's the way I like to think about it. I always like to add a story. Okay, so the story is you're trying to create the component of V, and suppose you start that V has two neighbors. So binomial n minus 1 comma p is 2, so it has two neighbors. Add two fictitious neighbors. Refill the reservoir. Okay? So now again, you have binomial n minus 1 comma p neighbors. Maybe it has 5 neighbors. Replenish the reservoir with 5 new points. And keep on going. All right, now at the end, you got some stuff that's not there because those were fictitious points. But certainly the size of the actual component is less than or equal to the size of what you got there. And in that process, you're doing exactly Galton-Watson, well, except it's binomial n minus 1p instead of Poisson, but that's very close to Poisson lambda. Indeed, you can analyze Galton-Watson with other distributions, so you could do this directly. So therefore, by the stochastic domination, the probability that the component has size greater than or equal to k is at most the probability that the Poisson is greater than or equal to k. And we know that has exponential decay. Remember, lambda is less than 1, so it has exponential decay. There was that lambda e to the 1 minus lambda. So what happens is, if it's exponential decay, by the way, why do logs always appear? That's a rhetorical question. Why do logs always appear? The reason why logs always appear in this area is because you have exponential decay, but you have n possible starting points. And so you want the failure probability to be 1 over n. So in order to get exponential decay down to 1 over n, sometimes it's 1 over n squared, sometimes it's 1 over n to the fourth, you need to throw in a log term on the exponential decay to make the exponential decay down to polynomially small. And that's what we do here. If we let little k be an appropriate constant, capital K log n, depending on just what the exponent was here, then the probability will drop like any power of n. In particular, by making capital K large enough, it'll drop like n to the minus 1. But there are only n possible starting points. So if the probability from a given starting point of getting this big component is little o of n to the minus 1, then it doesn't happen. So we get quite quickly that the maximal component is of size constant log n. And now we come to the great discovery of Erdős and Rényi, the giant component. And there are two great things about the giant component. First, that it exists. And second, that it's unique. And again, there are analogies to mathematical physics. If you look at percolation on ZD, for example, for a long, long time, all the physicists knew, but none of the mathematicians knew, that the giant component in the supercritical regime was unique. The infinite component, sorry. In the mathematical physics world, you look at infinite components. And infinite corresponds to giant, and finite actually corresponds to logarithmic, big O of log. It turns out those are the analogies. And in the mathematical physics world, it was, for those of us that were on the math side, it was an open question for a long time. If you are supercritical in Z12, do you get one infinite component, or do you get an infinite number of infinite components? And the answer is you get one infinite component. And that's the case here, the uniqueness. I want to jump to, because I'll be doing more on Thursday, I want to jump to describe. Let me jump to the Bowman free. I want to talk about some other processes, and I think maybe Lutz spoke about this, but it's worth speaking.
Briefly.
All right. Well, I'll speak about it briefly, too. So, I mean, here we're talking about random graph processes, and to me, Eris-Rani is the bedrock. I mean, this is the one you really want to understand, but it doesn't work all the time. Here's another process that was given by Tom Bowman and Alan Freeze. And so, again, you begin with an empty graph on n vertices, and you pick a random pair VW. Technically, VW should not be a previously chosen edge, but that's asymptotically negligible in the regime we're looking at. And what you do is you promote joining isolated points in the following sense. If V and W are both isolated, you join them. Otherwise, you simply pick another randomly chosen pair, V prime W, and that one you definitely join. There's no third choice, okay? So, all right, I mean, we're talking about random graph processes. This is one of them. And historically, it's very interesting. So I want to look at this one. And this is a general example of what's called an Akleoptis process for Dmitri Akleoptis. So I can rephrase it. I can say that each round, two random edges are chosen, VW and V prime W prime. And then you have a protocol for deciding which one you're going to add to the edge. And Bowman-Fries is the protocol. Add the first one if both vertices are isolated. Otherwise, add the second one. Now, there are 1,000 other protocols, but let's stick to this one for now. Here are some other reasons. So other things you can look at. You can look at Eris-Rani, but start. Have some different starting point besides the empty graph. That's something that's good to look at. You can look at what's called bounded size Akleoptis rules, and Nick Wormald and I have a paper on this. So what this means is, again, you have the two pairs, and all you do is look at the sizes of the components that the four points are in. And from that, you make your decision. But furthermore, there's some constant k, like 10, and if the component is bigger than 10, it's just big. Those are all treated the same. So this is a general protocol called a bounded size Akleoptis rule, and we have a lot of there's a lot of work on these processes. And there's all kinds of preference things we can do. We can prefer low-degree vertices, we can prefer high-degree vertices, we can... lots and lots of things that I think this week we'll be seeing a lot of them. Let's look at Bowman-Fries from the standpoint of susceptibility, and this was in my paper with Nick, we made this precise. Notice, again, the analogy to mathematical physics, that and if you think of the infinite grid and you put in, they call them bonds, we call them edges, they call them bonds. If you put in bonds with probability p, then the analogy to susceptibility is an infinite structure, but all the vertices look the same. I mean, Z2. So just look at the distribution of, look at the expected size of the component containing the origin. Same, and that's the analogy to the discrete version, because all the vertices look the same, so the expected size would anyway. That's the analogy, and now but we're looking at the finite thing, and S of t is the susceptibility at time t. Now first we look at isolated vertices. And it turns out isolated vertices are not too much of a problem. Again, Nick is the master at turning discrete processes into differential equations, so I'll just state the stuff about it. If you look at the proportion of isolated vertices, what's happening is that... Let me do the first part and the second. That's not a complete formula. First, with probability x1 squared, you did pick two isolated vertices, and so you reduced the number of isolated vertices by 2. So with probability x1 squared, it's going down by 2 over n. But otherwise, you just picked a random two vertices, and each one of them was isolated with probability x1 of t over n. No, x1 of t. So the expected number then would be 2x1 of t. But then with proportion, you divide by n. All right, so we get this result. And so what we get is a differential equation for x1. It doesn't have a particularly nice formula, but I mean, there it is. And this is a totally smooth function. And again, Nick has the backdrop to show that this is legitimate. And it's a smooth function, so x1 of 0 is 1, and then it's a decreasing function, and it approaches 0 as t goes to infinity. Notice t goes to infinity is not the end of the process because of the Erdős-Rényi time. So if t is 1,000, if you look at t equals 1,000, you don't have very many isolated vertices left. Okay, so you get this smooth function. In fact, you can write it out, but you have to solve a cubic, which I've told my students to do. I wouldn't do it. That's something I tell my students to do. So now you can look at the susceptibility, which is what we did for Bowman-Fries. And what happens is, with probability x1 squared of t, you took two isolated points and you joined them together. So what happened to the susceptibility? 1 squared plus 1 squared became 1 plus 1 squared. Well, it went up by 2. So the susceptibility went up, and it scaled by n, so the susceptibility went up by 2 over n. But otherwise, we're in the same position that we were in discussing Erdős-Rényi. So with probability 1 minus x1 squared, we're now picking a random vertex, and the increase is going to be 2s squared over n, the argument that we had before. And so now, again, we wave our hands and turn it into a differential equation. So we get that S prime is minus x1 squared. Not x. That should be, should be x1 squared of t. There's no 1 here. So S squared is minus, but remember, x1 is a nice function. X1 is a nice function that we've already done. And so this differential equation, it doesn't have a nice solution, but notice that the S prime is being driven by S squared. It's being driven by S squared, because after you just get a little bit away from t equals 0, see, at t equals 0, this term is 0, but once t gets greater than 0, this term will be a positive term. With positive probability, you're You are with positive probability, you are taking the second edge. After you've started for time t equals 0.001, then at that point, with positive probability, the first pair of points, they're not both isolated. So what happens is, if you look at this differential equation, not that it has a nice solution, and I don't think it does, but S prime is being driven by S squared, and that means you get a finite explosion. You get an explosion in finite time, which it turns out to be 1.1763. I mean, it's got to be something. So we just plug it in. And so that's just numerical calculation. And what we were able to prove was that that's where the giant component appears. That is, where the susceptibility goes to infinity and where the giant component appears, in this case, are one and the same. Again, this is a big problem in mathematical physics. There are some examples where this doesn't happen, but here it does happen. It does happen. Well, good timing. So I don't know how many of you are Neil Stephenson. How many of you are Neil Stephenson fans? Raise your hand. Okay. How many women are Neil Stephenson fans? Uh-oh, you're missing something. Oh, I don't know. He's just great. He could use an editor. I mean, he really just writes long, 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 long things. But this one is nice. If the math works well, why, then you should be sure of yourself. That's the whole point of math. So that's it for today. Thank you.
Questions? Come on, there got to be some questions. Then let's thank Joel again.
Thank you.
Right until.